cause it's getting harder and harder to breathe.
No, does it kill, does it burn, is it painful to learn that it's me that is out of control?
This summer, people like you will head out into the traffic, getting to work or picking up kids, even though the air is brown. It feels gritty, smells burnt. An alarming number of these ordinary people will be found dead, slumped over the wheel, or crumpled up on the sidewalk. The victims are pronounced dead at the hospital. Most death certificates will say heart attack. The real cause was air pollution, but the system doesn't count that. We are learning the death toll and other health impacts of air pollution from the work of a relatively few number of scientific studies. The subject hasn't been a big priority for governments, who know the economy is built by GM, Ford, Volkswagen, and Toyota. One of the major health studies has been ongoing since the 1970s at Harvard University at the Harvard School of Public Health. And Dr. Joel Schwartz, an environmental epidemiologist, has become one of the prominent advocates for cleaner air in America and elsewhere. 3 years ago, Dr. Schwartz told congressional staffers that based on his extensive studies, smog is killing 250,000 Americans a year. Quote, that's more than AIDS, plus breast cancer, plus prostate cancer, plus colon cancer, put together. End quote. Frankly, judging by their reaction to such warnings, the American government just doesn't give a damn. And just this March, the Bush administration was forced to reduce the amount of low-level ozone in our air. The American Lung Association has been clamoring for an ozone cleanup for years, saying lung damage from this smog component is hurting millions of people. But they had to join a lawsuit in 2003, filed by the legal outfit Earth Justice, with the environment groups Environmental Defense, Natural Resources Defense Council, and Sierra Club, among others, to push the government to enact its own Clean Air Act laws. 5 years of court battles later, the EPA announces an anemic improvement, an 8-hour limit of 0.075 parts per million instead of 0.08. Well, that's a change of 0.005, despite decades of new scientific understanding of smog since the Clean Air Act was passed back in the 1970s. That's all you get. Yet according to an ongoing Harvard study, ozone pollution is nasty, but tiny carbon particles, soot, is the big killer. The human body has no defense for these microscopic particles, so let's take a minute to learn about them.
It ain't pretty, and it could be dangerous.
There has always been dust. That is why you have hair in your nose, to help filter it out. The lungs have their own protective mechanisms. But industrial society has added two new features. First of all, tiny particles attract all kinds of these new toxic chemicals which were never present in natural air. These are the pesticides, a whole range of other human-made industrial chemicals, and heavy metals. Some of the heavy metal particles are actually from the breakdown in car and truck engines. Pistons and engine walls wear away and fly off into the air around us. A whole range of other toxic chemicals, including mercury and radioactive particles, comes from the smoke of coal-fired power stations. But the second factor, industrially produced particles are smaller than anything found in nature. They are measured in microns. I'll explain that in a minute. These tiny particles go into your lungs, but they don't stop there. They go directly through the cell wall system into your bloodstream. The toxic chemicals, heavy metals, and soot collect in your arteries and organs. Eventually, a major artery is blocked near the heart, and death results. To get the best of smog science explained for the general public, you should download two short podcasts I did 2 years ago. On the EcoShock Features page, grab a 21-minute piece called The Polluted Womb. It is an expose on science that shows how vehicle emissions damage the genes of babies right in the womb. That piece of work on Dr. Frederica Pereira of the Columbia Mailman School of Health was chosen for an independent producer showcase on the Pacifica network of stations in California. You should also get my earlier EcoShock feature on the work of Dr. Schwartz called Let's Talk About Smog. I'm just going to play a quick clip which explains the tiny exhaust particles that kill. In Europe, particles are measured by the number of micrograms per cubic meter. The authorities have decided that the 24-hour average should not exceed 65 micrograms per cubic meter. By comparison, when people smoked at the back of airplanes in the old days, they inhaled 200 or 300 micrograms per cubic meter. In North America, we only count particles 2.5 microns in diameter or less, the size that penetrates deeply into our breathing system. These are so-called fine particles. You'll hear scientists discuss the air quality as particulate matter 2.5 or PM 2.5. Almost half the PM 2.5 particles come from burning carbon, and 30 to 40% come from sulfates, depending on where you live. A period at the end of a sentence would contain at least 600 microns, maybe more. Human eyes can't see them. But is there any safe level? Is there a threshold where the human body tolerates particles in their lungs, beyond which we die? The Harvard team selected 6 cities in the United States, ranging from the former steel town of Steubenville, Ohio, to the less polluted Madison, Wisconsin. When all air quality and death rates were calculated, the scientists did not find any safe threshold. There is no really safe level of exhaust particles for humans, and not just humans. When Boston street air was given to lab rats, they died too. After 15 years of the study, statistics clearly showed the worse the air pollution, the sooner people died. Dr. Schwartz tells us, quote, "The difference in life expectancy between the cleanest town and the dirtiest town, it's 2 years," end quote. Some humans are more susceptible than others. Those with medical conditions like diabetes are threatened by smog. People already sick with respiratory infection have a lower threshold. And it turns out, 50% of the population has a gene that helps them detoxify a bit, which others lack. It's a 50-50 genetic chance. In one study in Philadelphia, there was a 7% increase in total deaths on smoggy days compared with clean air days. But these are not just feeble people who would have died within a few days anyway. The California Air Resources Board concludes smog-related premature deaths take away 14 years of expected living on average. Most victims would never have guessed that smog would suddenly kill them. Yet, our method of collecting death statistics lists the cause of death as heart attack or arrhythmia, not air pollution. As I say, you can download that whole feature, Let's Talk About Smog, at our website, ecoshock.org, on the EcoShock Features page. Well, we know how this works. The science is in, but the public doesn't know much, and governments who have been too well informed by experts like Dr. Joel Schwartz are ignoring the deaths of hundreds of thousands of their citizens. If a serial killer left 10 bodies along the New York State Thruway, a team of hundreds of cops would investigate. If 1,000 bodies were found, the FBI and the terrorism teams would sweep in to stop the killing. But when our unregulated transportation system kills hundreds of thousands of our people, it doesn't even make the front page of the paper. You don't hear it raised in the presidential debates. We drive dirty and power up dirty and die dirty without any protest.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. We know the air is unfit to breathe and our food is unfit to eat.
Okay, let's hear from Dr. Schwartz himself in this exclusive Radio EcoShock interview.
So you put that all together and it's clear that particles in the air are triggering heart attacks and arrhythmias and killing tens of thousands of people a year.
Well, I have to say, as a layperson, I am confused sometimes about the different dangers in air pollution. One scientist warns about ozone. You're talking about microparticles, and then we have the PAHs. Can you help us quickly to understand the differences between these things and how important each might be?
Sure. There are many different kinds of air pollutants that we produce in our society, and many of them are bad for us. Usually in different ways. The pernicious thing about particles, which you produce from any kind of combustion, is that they seem to have effects not just in the lungs, which you might expect, you breathe them in, but that get out into the rest of the body. And partly that's because the very smallest particles, which you get particularly from traffic and diesel engines, are stellar productions of nanoparticles, can actually get out of the lung and into the bloodstream directly. And the other ones that get stuck in the lungs nevertheless have metals and other things on them that are soluble and can get out into the body and do things. So they tend to have more of the effects on cardiovascular disease. Ozone is a very oxidizing gas. I mean, it's like bleach, in a sense. And when you inhale it, it causes a lot of irritation in the lung. And over the long term, that may do a lot of bad things. And there are studies in monkeys showing permanent lung damage as a result of that. And in the short run, if you have pneumonia or some other respiratory disease, it can make it get worse. And of course, if you make everybody's respiratory diseases get worse, more people are going to die from them. And so there's some mortality that's associated with ozone exposure as well. PAHs, some of them are particles, in fact, and some of them are gases. And the primary concern with them is that they're carcinogenic. And so EPA estimates are that as a result of those things, there are hundreds of cases of cancer a year as a result of PAHs in the air. However, that's much smaller than the amount of excess deaths due to particles in general from heart and lung disease, which is on the order of 100,000 or 200,000 deaths per year. So in rank ordering, I would say particles are the biggest problem, followed by ozone, and PAHs are a problem, but they're a much smaller one.
Well, some of the studies that I've seen, one by Frederica Pereira, for example, seem to point towards a mixture of pesticides with the vehicle emissions. Do we know the real toxicity of just the vehicle emissions, independent of these other toxic chemicals sort of swimming around in our air?
No, that's a very good point. We aren't exposed to pure particles of any particular kind, and that slowed down toxicological studies for a long time because they didn't know what to expose their animals to. And when they took pure particles of a particular type, pure ammonium sulfate or pure carbon soot, you know, nothing much happened. I mean, you know, at high doses, things happened, but it didn't seem to fit in with the epidemiology. And then they started sucking in particles from out of the air in cities, concentrating them up a bit, and sending these higher concentration doses of particles into chambers with animals, and all sorts of stuff started happening. So clearly these things are interacting with each other, and that's part of the problem of figuring out which are the things of greatest concern. There are, you know, some studies that do point to traffic particles being worse than average in ways that it seemed reasonably convincing. There was a study done in Germany where they found that they interviewed people in the intensive care unit after they'd had a heart attack. They interviewed everybody in the city of Stuttgart who came in, you know, with a heart attack during a certain period and survived long enough to be interviewed. And they asked them, well, you know, what were you doing in the couple of hours before the heart attack happened? And, you know, what about the same day of the week, same time of the day last week? What were you doing? And they compared the answers. And the big difference was that they were a lot more likely to have been in traffic on the day that they had their heart attack. And it seemed like being in traffic caused an immediate increase in your risk of having a heart attack for that hour that you were in traffic. And so it's hard to imagine that that doesn't give a strong signal towards traffic particles. But nevertheless, those traffic particles do, and fresh traffic particles, before they've had a chance to pick a lot of other stuff up. And there are some other studies looking at diesel engine exhaust that have found changes in people. But certainly, particles do pick things up on their surface and do become very complex mixtures. And so the bigger particles, it's even more of a problem. So that larger particles are more likely to have pesticides and herbicides and things on them. And that's why, you know, people in farming communities argue, well, you know, most of the particles in our air are wind-blown dust. That can't really be bad for you. And if it was just, you know, clay, that would be true. But it's not. It's clay that has pesticides and herbicides and all sorts of other stuff attached to its surface. And so it may well be that the clay is just acting as a vehicle, as it were, for getting other stuff into your lung.
And how small are the particles that you've been studying that are dangerous? And, well, just how small are they?
Well, the big division is between combustion particles, particles that are produced by burning stuff, right, and particles that sort of occur in the natural world by erosion and things being ground down and stuff. And combustion particles are less than a micron in diameter. So that's a millionth of a meter. So they're really small. They're much thinner than a hair. And those particles are more likely to have dangerous chemicals on them and lots of metals on them and things like that. But as you said, partly that's by mixing with each other and picking up these things and changing. But those are the most dangerous particles. Now, the other particles you get in the air are basically between, well, you get particles of all sizes, right? But the bigger they are, the quicker they fall out. And so the ones that are between 1 and 10 microns are still small enough to get down your throat and into your lung. And those tend to be produced by mining, by plowing, by cars driving over the road and kicking up dust, by all sorts of, or by wind-blown dust if you're in a dry area. And those particles have cores that if you sort of looked at them under a super microscope, they're little rocks, right? I mean, that's what they are. But the problem is they're little rocks that have all sorts of stuff attached to the outside. And what that stuff is varies a lot from place to place. And so they don't seem, on average, to be as toxic, but there's a wide variability.
I'm told that one reason that diesel fuel for North American truckers has become so expensive is a majority of the cars sold in Europe have diesel engines now because they get a little better mileage. Do these new European cars have sufficient particle filters to protect the population?
No. If I put a blindfold on you and flew you around in an airplane for 24 hours, landed you, took you out of the airport, put you on a city street with the blindfold, you could tell me whether you were in America or Europe just by smelling the air. They have much more diesel particles in the air in Europe than we do. And in general, particulate air pollution is higher in Europe than in North America because of this fascination with diesel. They have new standards that are starting to kick in called the Euro 5 standards, which will require fairly strict control on diesel engines, but still not quite as strict as the new standards that EPA put out in 2007 for diesel cars and trucks in the United States. So they're still going to be dirtier than the same cars sold in the U.S. But the problem with diesel engines is that they last a very long time. And these new rules only apply to new cars and trucks. And so all the old cars and trucks, now in the U.S., there are very few cars, so all the old trucks don't have to retrofit. In Europe, not only do they have old trucks that don't have to retrofit, but they have a huge number of cars that were bought when control standards were much more lax, and they're going to be on the road for 10 years.
So they're looking at a new health problem that in the making.
Absolutely, and that's why, you know, a funny thing happened in Europe a couple of years ago, which is they had these scientific panels that recommended what their particle standards should be, and then all of a sudden, you know, the auto industry went in and basically torpedoed that, and they completely turned around from what their initial proposal was to come out with a much weaker particle standard, so that in the United States, our standard is that for these combustion particles, no more than 15 micrograms per cubic meter as an annual average. In Europe, it's 25 micrograms per cubic meter as an annual average. It's 60% higher levels that they tolerate, and they still have a very large number of cities that are that aren't going to make it.
Well, Harvard's been studying air pollution since the 1970s, and I know that you have testified about it before Congress. What should we be doing about this problem?
Well, you know, I like to tell people that particulate air pollution kills more people a year in the United States than AIDS, breast cancer, and prostate cancer put together. But the difference is we know the cure. We just need to do it. And so there are still a large number of power plants in the United States that don't have scrubbers on them to remove the precursors, the chemicals that turn into particles once they get out of the smokestack. And EPA issued a rule a couple of years ago to bring down particle levels in the U.S. that required them to reduce their emissions of sulfur oxides, which is the main thing they put out that turns into particles. But when that rule is fully in effect, which isn't going to be for, you know, another 10 years, 25% of the power plants in the United States will still not have scrubbers on them. So there's a real simple thing you could do. You could say, no, I'm sorry. You want to have a coal-burning power plant? You need a scrubber. And that would take care of the remaining 25%. They issued a fairly stringent rule for diesel engines, but no retrofit requirement. You know, and on construction equipment and trucks and things, these engines last for 30 years. So a simple thing to do is to say, you know, these engines get rebuilt every 3 to 5 years. When you take it in to rebuild it, you put on a particle filter, period. And in 5 years, every diesel engine in America would have a particle filter, or be replaced by a new one that has a particle filter. So there are things that you can do. We just need the political will to do it.
Well, Dr. Joel Schwartz, it's been a privilege talking with you. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Well, one thing that I think is becoming more became an issue in the 70s and at the high price of oil is coming back is wood-burning stoves. And if you know, if you live in a cabin in Montana, that's a great way to heat your house. But if you live in a county with a million people, you're using a technology that has, you know, relatively poor combustion that produces a large amount of particles that come out of a very low chimney into the street that all your neighbors live on. And I'm nervous that we had a very bad problem with that in the 70s, and there's a chance that it's going to start coming back, and we need to be very careful about that.
Well, thank you. We've been talking with Dr. Joel Schwartz of Harvard University, and I really appreciate your coming on the show today.
Sure thing.
That was Dr. Joel Schwartz. He is a professor of environmental epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health. You should know that the black carbon soot we have been talking about as a public health risk is also the second largest cause of global warming. Unlike sulfate particles, which reflect sunlight and may even temporarily cool the Earth, black soot absorbs sunlight and increases global warming. This is particularly true as these vast collections of airborne soot land on the snowy Arctic. The snow becomes a dirty gray color, which absorbs vast amounts of heat, instead of the white reflecting it back into space. Dr. Schwartz testified at a hearing on black carbon and global warming at the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. It was chaired by Henry Waxman on October 18, 2007. Dr. Schwartz was one of five leading American researchers to testify. Joel Schwartz made a strong case that the United States should clean up its own carbon emissions at home rather than depending on global emissions trading. While it makes sense to help the Chinese reduce their emissions as they develop, America is one of the two top polluters in the world, and cleaning up American coal smokestacks with scrubbers and American vehicle emissions with particle filters or electric cars would have a double benefit. It would help fight off the worst of climate change and save hundreds of thousands of American lives a year. I've been saying this all along. We are just deluding ourselves to death, thinking we can go on polluting in North America or Europe by buying credits in some faraway land. Everyone has to stop pollution where they live. For those Europeans who feel superior to America when it comes to being green, Dr. Schwartz has a shocking message. Europeans are literally in danger of their lives due to continued dependence on dirty coal power, and now the added increase of particulates from all those new diesel car sales. In his presentation to Congress, which is available on the net as a PDF file, there is one of the two most frightening maps I have ever seen. The most scary map ever of the current age was posted by Sir James Lovelock in his late 2007 presentation to the Royal Society. It shows the developing New Earth regime under climate change. The tropics dry out and balloon up toward the Arctic, where the last remaining temperate wet zones remain. It is a remaking of the Earth coming every day. But Dr. Joel Schwartz has a close second with his simple map showing black carbon emission zones on the planet. Heavily polluted areas are shown in gray. Zones loaded with deadly particulates are shown in black. In North America, there are gray zones with black circles along the northeast, along the Louisiana-Texas refinery zone, and of course in Southern California. These are where most smog deaths occur. But all of Europe is one vast gray area, and there are massive concentrations of black dots. People there are being poisoned, whether they know it or not, by the smog of coal power and vehicle emissions. There is almost nowhere in Europe to escape from it. The public health bill and the loss, personal loss, from unnecessary deaths will be enormous. There is another new report on another way to die from smog, this time in England. Professor George Knox, emeritus professor at Birmingham University, has found a direct link between exhaust fumes and death by pneumonia. By cross-checking statistics, Knox found that during an 8-year period up to 2004, the 35 smoggiest areas of Britain had 14,000 more pneumonia deaths than the national average. While deaths of all kinds, including cancer, rose in smoggy areas, pneumonia was the killer that stood out in his study. Professor Knox said, quote, "Road transport was the chief source of the emissions." He compared these deaths as greater than the 4,000 killed in London in the early 1950s. It's a continuing plague caused by car and truck exhaust. His study was published in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health. On the map presented to Congress by Dr. Joel Schwartz, another black and gray belt of death, mostly black, extends across the whole of northern India, where almost a billion people live. And as you would expect, much of China is saturated with dangerous gray and deadly black. We can expect hundreds of millions of deaths in China and India just from industrial smog. Electric-powered cars, trucks, and trains could save many of these people. The power would have to come from carbon-free, renewable energy. Or we could stop making new cars until we find health solutions. Why kill ourselves? We know how to do this, but apparently humanity has more decades of unimaginable suffering and personal loss before we try.
A scientist tells people the truth. When times are good, when the truth offers no threat, people don't mind. But when times are very, very bad, well, a magician tells people what they wish were true.
If you made it to the end of this broadcast, you have already taken the first step. Most people cannot stand to hear about it, much less demand action. Now you know, smog hurts your children and might kill you before your time, and it is preventable. And the same actions that cut carbon soot also help prevent the worst of climate change. The two battles are closely related. The answer is to stop burning carbon. In the meantime, I am exposed just like you. Being poor, my home is just 300 yards from a busy four-lane highway. the danger zone. There is a 6-lane freeway within a mile. The government wants to make it 8 lanes, and 80 diesel trains a day pass by in the little valley below me. Inside my house, I have 2 HEPA air filters running 24 hours a day. I wanted to ask Dr. Schwartz whether these would save my lungs and heart, but I already know the answer. They help, but the only real solution is to move out of the gray zone, to leave the city for cleaner country air, and one day, some years soon, I will do just that. But first, I'll join you to fight for cleaner air.
Wake up!